This is the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. The program tonight is also sponsored by the Business and Leadership Member-Led Forum, Kevin O'Malley, a chair. Our program tonight is the San Francisco Green Film Festival, Lights, Camera, Action, and Storytelling. It's my pleasure to introduce Rachel Kaplan, who will be our moderator. Rachel is the founder and CEO of the San Francisco Green Film Festival. We're all grateful for her pioneering work. This year, the San Francisco Green Film Festival will be held from May 28th through June 4th. The dates again, May 28th through June 4th. And you will have on your seat when you came in a brochure that tells you the films that are coming, so that you will have a look before the actual festival begins and can pick and choose what you would like to do. Tonight, Rachel will introduce our distinguished panel. Rachel, you are on.
Thank you, Anne. I'd really like to thank Anne Clark and the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum at the Commonwealth Club for inviting us here this evening. Thrilled to be introducing three wonderful filmmakers that have joined us this evening. I will tell you a little about our guests, and then we'll get right on with the discussion. This discussion came about because at the film festival, our team reviews many hundreds of films each year, and we're just constantly inspired by the different types of stories we see, documentaries, animation, music, live performance, even sci-fi movies. And that got us thinking about all the different ways that stories are important, how they can help inspire new generations of activists. So we invited these guests here today, and we're going to have this conversation about how films can help us cut through the noise, connect with people, and build momentum for action on environmental causes. I'm joined tonight by, to my right, Mark DeSena. As the founder of Content Films, Mark wears a lot of hats. As a writer, director, and producer, he's created award-winning work in narrative and documentary feature films, shorts, television programming, commercials, and web films. His films have been shown at festivals all over the world, including Sundance, Toronto, Mill Valley, and of course the Green Film Festival, where film screenings have included Watershed, executive produced and narrated by Robert Redford. His new film, How We Live, A Journey Towards a Just Transition, featuring Bay Area activist Gopal Dayaneni, shows at this year's Green Film Festival on May 29th. Liam Mahan is an independent documentary filmmaker whose work has been nominated by the Directors Guild of America for outstanding directorial achievement. She's been a fellow at the Sundance Institute Documentary Editing and Story Lab and the Producers Institute for New Media Technologies. In 2013, she completed Come Hell or High Water, The Battle for Turkey Creek, about a group of determined Mississippians who struggle to save their endangered Gulf Coast community in the face of rampant development, pollution, and disaster. The film won the Green Tenacity Award at the 2014 Green Film Festival, and Leah's also been working on with Gulf Coast NGOs to develop the Bridge the Gulf project we'll be discussing this evening. And at the end of our table here, we have Kevin White, an award-winning producer, director, writer, who has worked in media since 1982. In 1984, he founded Full Frame Productions, and in 1988, he created the nonprofit Filmmakers Collaborative SF. His films have been screened at the Berlin Film Festival, San Francisco International, and many more. His awards include Emmys and a Cine Golden Eagle. Kevin is currently working on a documentary feature, The Fire Next Time, about megafires and using the recent Rim Fire as the springboard for that project. We'll be talking about it this evening. And you can join us for a work-in-progress screening and discussion on this new film at the Green Film Festival on May 30th. Welcome. So we're going to jump right in, and we'll be sharing some clips as we go along this evening as our guests uncover their approaches and successes to bringing their stories to the screen. So I'd like to kick off talking about that stories. When you're looking for stories and ideas for films, I mean, what really draws you in and makes you think this is going to be a great story to bring to an audience? Do you start with an issue or a character and an incident? So if Leah, if I could throw that to you and we could talk about your film, Come Hell or High Water.
And the Come Hell or High Water, though, I would say it was a slow, kind of organic process that started with a relationship with a friend. The main character, Derek Evans, and I were research interns on the Eyes on the Prize series about the civil rights movement. And he always told stories about the community that he was from on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. And I was fascinated by his stories, and he always said, you know, if you think I'm a great storyteller, you should meet my relatives. And in 2001, we finally went there together because it became clear that this little community called Turkey Creek might not exist much longer because a city had grown up around it, gaming had been legalized on the Gulf Coast, and all around it was sprawl, and this land that had been swampland, and therefore his ancestors who were emancipated slaves had been able to buy the land there, was now very valuable real estate. And so whether or not this community would exist much longer was really unclear. And he had wanted to write a book, but time seemed short. And so he invited me to come with him and try to make a documentary. And so originally we thought we were really talking about history and using oral history of this really interesting isolated community as a way to protect it and possibly preserve it. But things became really interesting when the local mayor was backing a huge development in that area and called everybody standing in the way of it a bunch of dumb bastards for standing in the way of progress. And all of this was happening before Katrina. And I thought I was finding a conclusion to that story just before the storm. And so when Hurricane Katrina came and wiped out the whole city and a lot of other communities like Turkey Creek on the Gulf Coast, the story became much bigger. And so the bigger it became, the more I focused on Derek as a main character and looked at all of these events through his experience. So this was a slow, long process. It actually took 12 years. And I was sort of gradually roped in, and once I was in, I couldn't turn around. That's unlike my other earlier films where in one case there was an issue I was interested in about urban development and displacement, and I kind of found a story. And in another case, I was fascinated by an individual, and I made a film about an artist. So I think, you know, it depends. I think each story is different, and you kind of follow the path where it leads.
Should we look at a clip?
Sure.
We have a clip from, can you tell us what the clip is?
So this is just a 1 minute trailer for Come Hell or High Water.
My great-grandfather's grandfather founded this community on this land.
It is the best commercial spot in that area in South Mississippi.
Everywhere they can push a little dirt back and pour a little concrete, they're putting something in there.
I'm the kind of man who'll defend whatever I have to defend, whatever way I have to defend it.
Somebody has to try and stop this. This is crazy.
Recovery in Mississippi is going good, but there is no recovery in Mississippi.
Not my community.
huge. This is like a Bible story of a tragedy, you know, and it's unfolding. It hasn't even hit yet.
Thanks, Leah. I think what's tremendous in this film is, as you say, it took 12 years filming it. You started out thinking it was about one thing, and then it builds with these layers and layers and layers. And even at the end of the film, there's the Deepwater Horizon explosion. So it's a story that just keeps building.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's, yeah, part of the story is that Derek was a teacher, and he's very naturally a teacher. And doing this work and being drawn into being a reluctant activist and an environmental activist, which he wasn't before, really caused him a lot of pain and took a huge toll on him. So you really see him transformed over the course of that time. And that's partly the subject of the film. And I just want to say thank you to you and the Green Film Festival, because this film is... been at some festivals, and it aired on the America Reframe series. When we showed it here in San Francisco, Derek was able to come out and connect with some of the great partners that we've had, including the Sierra Club, which Rose Johnson, who's another leader, who's an important character in the film, was a leader with the Mississippi Sierra Club. And so they've done a lot to support the outreach for the film. And it was a really great discussion and a great outlet for the film.
Thanks. Kevin White, how what brought you to your most recent story?
My good friend and colleague, Steve Most, right here, I said, Kevin, we should think about doing a film on the Rimfire. And we found a little bit of funding, and we started working on it, and I have to say, it's one of those films where, you know, sometimes you pull the story, and sometimes the story pulls you. And I think that every time you make a film, the arc, the trajectory of each film has its own kind of, its own arc, its own trajectory. And you end up having to decide, all right, how much story do I want? How much character do I want? And as you get deeper into it, I find that, you know, it just keeps pulling you when you really are connecting with it. So Steve and I you know, the layers start to peel away, and we realize this is actually a very important film, and we've been feeling like it's there isn't much information about the threat to our forests right now in terms of fires. And I think that the Rim Fire was a great example of that, and I think that it became evident as we got deeper into this story that it was really kind of an important story to start to get out. So we did a 13-minute show, which we just put up on Vimeo, and we're up to 13,000 views in like 4 weeks or something like that. And I think that, you know, when you talk about facilitating change, when you talk about ways that you can facilitate change, you really have to work with a lot of affinity nonprofits, you know, nonprofits and different organizations that will really help you get that word out. And so we were looking at some of the statistics about who's watching this film, where's this being embedded, and who's watching this so quickly. Well, it's all the firefighters, all the wildfire firefighters. They have a website, and thousands of them are watching it through that. You know, so it was really interesting about this thing about reaching out to your audience, determining your core audience, and working back from that, like kind of reverse engineering in terms of getting the word out and the distribution. How many films, good films, have been made and sit on a shelf or don't really get the traction that they maybe deserve? And I think a lot of that, you know, the cliche is the work starts after the film is finished, right? So, but Steve and I are working on doing a feature-length film and as well and on this, because, and I think, you know, having all these, starting your community, building your community early is really helping us in terms of fundraising and you know, finding funding for the film and all that kind of stuff. So,
I mean, I think I see that with all of you, and knowing about your films and your work, that you're working with nonprofit partners, you're working with government agencies, you're working with many other people in creating these stories, but also in like bringing them to audiences. So, Mark, do you want to? Can you tell us a little bit about some of your work?
Sure. And the great thing about being a filmmaker is that you know you sometimes get chosen to tell the story, which we did for Watershed. But then the stories that you tell sometimes choose your next path. And I'm actually very excited that How We Live has been programmed in the Green Film Festival, because it's not necessarily an environmental film. And I think what I love about it is that it's a systemic critique. It's looking at things that are root causes of many of the environmental issues that we are facing, but also many of the social issues that we're facing. So this systemic critique is really looking at this economic system that we're dealing with, capitalism, and really looking at what is driving many of the issues we face, which is you know the rapacious use of natural resources without regard to cost, and a big factor is you know the exploitation of labor. That you know those issues are really connected, and the film brings those two together, and it's really driving a lot of the things that I'm looking at and trying to connect the dots between you know what we have this massive climate change issue that we're dealing with, and also the greatest economic inequality in the history of mankind. And are those issues connected? I think they are. I mean, if you know, and we need to start looking at what is the connection between climate change and Black Lives Matter. They are intricately connected, and we just need to dive down further. So the films that we're looking at and doing are not only environmental, but also diving into the social issues. And our work spans from feature films and also really, really delving into the short film form, which we're finding is a very, very powerful way to go. And this clip, if we could show it, is sort of a compilation of a lot of the work that we've been doing over the past 3 or 4 years.
The time is now. We're at a crossroads. We can continue on this like business as usual path, or we can create solutions for our future generations.
The future of humanity and the planet must be built on solidarity, on people around the world standing together on a common platform and pushing for the same solution.
We can start to reimagine our relationship the whole living ecosystem. I think we might reroute our activities, not reroute rivers, not reroute waterways.
The new economy, post-grow, when we fear, call it as you want, but we need something different.
By looking at how we live, we can find how we can live better, more interconnected lives. And maybe even be happier for it.
Sure, sure, absolutely.
Can you tell us?
So this is a trailer about our Rimfire film, and it's like a 2-minute trailer.
It's very difficult to express the power of a wildfire. As it came up over the horizon behind me here, it just was a giant wall of red. Now, this is Dante's Inferno. There's just nothing that is going to stop this.
I saw this 20,000-foot column of smoke rise up like an atomic bomb. At that point, I knew this thing had gone from a bad fire to a holocaust.
The Rimfire was a really good example of where a lot of scientists and forest managers believe wildfire is headed, which is to these really large size events, what's being termed megafires.
this rim fire truly was a devastating, catastrophic event for the effects on just the web of life that's now so disrupted out there. It affected this ecosystem over tens of thousands of acres that burned in the most intense fashion.
No seeds, no trees, no nutrients in the soil are left because the fire was so hot. That's just a tragic loss.
Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, and often California are experiencing these catastrophic fires. And really the cause is too much fuel.
Our landscapes are at significant risk. We're seeing large fires in landscapes born and bred of fire now being destroyed by fire.
What's going on in the background of all of this is you have climate change, which is constantly pushing the conditions to be drier, the fuels to be drier, the weather to be more extreme.
We've got to think about fire in a different way. We've all pretty much grown up thinking that we have the ability to suppress all fires, and that's simply not true.
We can create the forest conditions that we know are resilient, that sustain the ecosystem services, the carbon, the water, the hydropower, all the resources and the benefits that we like to get out of forests. Right now, we're at a tipping point, and we need to consciously make that decision one way or the other.
You have just seen the clip on the rim fire. Thank you so much for that and our other clips. They're really very powerful. This is Ann Clark. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is the San Francisco Green Film Festival, Lights, Camera, Action, and Storytelling, with Mark DeCina, who's founder of Contact Films, writer and director of The Watershed, Exploring a New Water Ethic for the New West, Leah Mahand, who's producer and director of The Battle for Turkey Creek, which is a very obviously a very powerful story, as they all are, and Kevin White, who's founder and executive director of the Filmmakers Collaborative San Francisco. Our moderator is Rachel Kaplan, founder and CEO of the San Francisco Green Film Festival. In just a few minutes, I'll be walking by and collecting your question cards, so please put your questions on the card so we can answer them as the program goes on. And I'll return to Rachel, who will continue with our panel.
So, Kevin White, we saw there a clip from your upcoming film about megafires. You mentioned that you had been working with community partners and that working with the firefighters had helped increase the views of the clip online. But how do you get around just preaching to the choir?
Excellent question. I mean, I think that what's really important on some level is you have to start to think about where your core audience is. Mm. And, you know, these days we're kind of thinking about film like reverse engineering a little bit. Like we start from audience and we say, what stories are really going to resonate with that audience? You know, and I think you know, making a film that resonates with the, 1.5 million firefighters, actually, that's an audience I might not have thought about necessarily. Mm-hmm. And yet they are going to take that film and they're going to show it to other people that we may not reach. So it's kind of audience is this whole Venn diagram, you know, and you start in the middle, but then there's all these intersecting audiences. And I think the key to reaching beyond just the you know, preaching to the choir is making sure that the audiences, you give them a story that is, you know, has some kind of human trait and element to it that everybody can relate to. If you get, you know, one of the challenges I have, and I suspect you encounter this all the time at your festival, is there's a lot of really important, powerful films that afterwards, you know, they should just hand out the razor blades. You know what I mean? And it's really depressing sometimes.
Yes.
And I guess I feel like you need to have a positive side of the story. So in the Rimfire piece, there's this amazing collection of different environmental groups and different citizens, loggers to environmental activists, and they are all coming together to work on consensus building and collaboration to work with the Stanislaus National Forest and the Yosemite to come up with solutions and really help galvanize the public towards, you know, recovery of those watersheds and of those storied landscapes. And so I think that there's something about, you know, if you can show citizens working towards that, and you citizens who have traditionally been at odds, I think, again, that makes it that much easier to have a film that will play to that audience. And, of course, the key is having nonprofit groups or a team of distributors to really help you get that out there and figure out the points of commonality of consensus. And I think, you know, because divisiveness is not serving anyone. So you have to work beyond that, I guess. So
I think you're right. And the task for all of us is to present stories that can uplift and inspire people and connect to real projects and real work being done in our communities. We see it all the time at the festival with the films that we screen and the partners that come in. And I know that it's so much more than just showing movies in this work we're doing to get people involved in movements. Leah Mahan, maybe you could tell us a little bit about why Turkey Creek is so much more than just a movie and what sprung out of that project.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I was going to say is that because of the nature of the story, it was about the evolution of an activist, someone who saw himself as a teacher and a Native son and just felt this responsibility to do something to save his community. Suddenly he was a local leader and then a regional leader and then a national spokesperson on issues that he was just learning as he went. And so one of his strengths was that he built alliances with people in all these different sectors, and that's really how he was able to make the progress that he did. So, you know, the Sierra Club, the Audubon Society, the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, and down to, you know, the State Department of Transportation. I mean, there were people in government and nonprofits that he was working with that, you know, became aware of the story. He also, after Katrina, showed up in the news and was more broadly known. So as his sphere broadened, you know, the reach of the film broadened too. And after Katrina, one of the things that happened was that suddenly there were all these other communities that were facing total reconstruction. And, you know, all of this money for recovery coming to the Gulf Coast and often going to infrastructure and rebuilding the casinos and definitely not going to rebuild low-income communities and communities of color. And so his experience was suddenly very relevant. And so all those communities wanted to tell their story and felt either misrepresented or overlooked by the mainstream media. And so we worked together to create this project called Bridge to the Gulf. And that we actually got some major funding from the Kellogg Foundation and created this thing in 2010. So it was like the significant outreach funding that I had was years before I finished the film. And then when the film was done, I didn't really have much money. But that built a base for the film and a network of people on the Gulf Coast and in the region who really, you know, knew how committed both of us were to telling not just this story, but mm-hmm. other related stories. And I don't know if you want to show the clip from that. There's a 2-minute clip that's about Bridge the Gulf that I think will help explain that. And it was actually created here in San Francisco at the Bay Area Video Coalition, the BETA website for that, and it's existed for 5 years. And
we have 40% of the nation's wetlands here in Louisiana.
We trap, we catch oysters, and it's gonna be a long time before we're gonna be able to do that again.
They spraying that dispersant everywhere.
That's a scary situation. Then
all the birds are gone. Where did the birds go?
So many people. This is their livelihood. This is all they know. We still haven't fully recovered from Hurricane Katrina.
All of the communities, from Portersville Bay to Port Arthur, Texas, are persistently highly vulnerable to natural and or man-made disasters.
Katrina washed all these communities together, and
In their desperation, they started thinking about how they were connected.
There were people that were coming in documenting their stories, but they didn't have access to their own stories.
So we started thinking about a kind of a digital storytelling initiative, and it gradually evolved into a website and a media campaign to help all these other Gulf Coast communities to articulate their stories and have them heard.
This is the tool that we'll be using. At times, it can be used as a weapon even, you know, to document things that no one else would believe otherwise.
We want to diversify the picture. We want to diversify the voice.
They say if it's here, prove it. That's what we're doing. We're just uneducated fishermen. If we can find it, anybody that wants to can find it.
We wanted to make sure that people felt that they could not just be the subject, but they also could contribute to it. It's the foundation of how movements are built. You know, there's a spark that happens in this place, and a spark happens in this place. And soon enough, there's enough sparks that a fire is created.
Community is not these local officials or state officials that have sold these people and these national resources to big energy companies. We are the community, and we know what we know about where we live.
Thank you for sharing that with us. And did you find when you set this up, there was a real willingness for people to share their stories with it?
Yes. I mean, that was the impetus really came from people on the Gulf Coast in places like Turkey Creek who really wanted to tell their stories. And in many cases, they already were telling their stories in various ways, but this provided a common platform and a way for people to share information, share stories. And so really the strength of this is a blog with dozens of contributors. And sometimes we've done special projects. We did something with StoryCorps. But a lot of it is, you know, just first-person stories and essays from people.
Where can we find those online?
So it's bridgethegulfproject.org.
Great, thanks. Yeah. I think Mark DeSena, while we're talking about campaigns that spring out of films, Watershed, your film Watershed had a pretty significant take action campaign around it. How do you gauge the impact of a campaign like that, or whether the success of a project?
Sure, yeah. And it's pretty critical, I think, if you're doing a film, and a little bit to what Kevin was talking about earlier, thinking about your audience, it's very important to think about your goal before you start. And with the Redford Center, they were looking to reconnect the Colorado River to the ocean, which I didn't even realize that it doesn't flow to its delta, and it still doesn't, although there was a short pulse flow just recently. But their goal was to raise $10 million to buy water rights from farmers that no longer use the water, and they've raised close to $9 million, and the campaign is still going on pretty strongly. But they, with that goal in mind, they wanted to make the film available to anybody or anybody that would have a community screening. So the film has had over 500 community screenings. It's been in 52 festivals, and it still keeps going. I kind of joke that, you know, as an independent filmmaker, you want some event, some current event that keeps your film top of mind. And I was thinking of a drought, and I didn't really mean to make it as bad as it really, really was. But that has kept the film top of mind, and also, it's a huge issue. And the thing that was really a challenge with the film is, you know, we were tasked with making a positive film about water, which, as I dove into it, I thought, oh, yeah, no problem. I can do that. We can do that. But it's a very divisive issue. And so that was a task, going back to the idea of how you connect people to your story, is that, you know, it's, we had Robert Redford as a narrator, but we chose not to have other talking heads, experts in the film. We found six characters that lived on the geographic diversity of the river and water use diversity of the river. and let them tell their stories and provide the solutions that they're actually doing. So it's, you know, it spanned everything from recreation to farming to cities. And, you know, people, I think, resonated with that. They wanted to see themselves in a film. And I think that's how, as storytellers, you want that connection with an audience. You want an empathy to develop with your audience. And that's how people remember it. And just another point, we just had a study done on another project that we did by the Center for Media and Social Impact. And as a film we did called Stand Up Planet. And it looked at global development issues through the lens of stand-up comedy. And, you know, you may think that, wow, it's, you know, how can global poverty and sanitation and AIDS be entertaining? But what the study found is that if people connect with a character and they have empathy for a character, they're more likely to remember the information about what you're trying to get across. It's cloaked with humor, and humor is the gateway to empathy. You make people laugh, people connect with you. So, and that's been a, you know, I've been tasked with these things, but now it's definitely a part of my tool belt as a storyteller, is to use empathy, use humor, use anything you can to connect with your audience.
I've got questions here from, handing over to Anne Clark.
This is Anne Clark, and you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is the San Francisco Green Film Festival, Lights, Camera, Action, and Storytelling. Now it's time for audience questions. But before that, I want to introduce again our panel, Mark DeSinoff, who's founder of Content Films, writer and director, Watershed, Exploring a New Water Ethic from the New West, whom you've just heard from. Leah Mahan, who's producer and director, Come Hell or High Water, The Battle for Turkey Creek. Kevin White, founder and executive director, Filmmakers Collaborative, San Francisco. And our moderator, Rachel Kaplan, founder and CEO of the San Francisco Green Film Festival. I also wanted just to tag along a little bit on Mark's remarks. We've had programs about the Colorado here at the Commonwealth Club. And for those of you who are still interested in what's happening, there is a DVD on Watershed that is available. Go online and Raise the River, Reconnect with the Colorado, which is a very nice booklet and very well done. And again, Renewal, which is what Mark was talking about just a minute ago, and that there was a historic flow from the Colorado. And I get teary-eyed because I'm actually a big Colorado River fan, into the Gulf, the Bay. So there is progress being made, and I wanted to share that with you. And you have been part of the audience that's been following that here and on the radio. So we thank Mark and all of our panelists tonight, because from my perspective, they do such wonderful work. And it's not easy. It's hard. It's tough. There are lots of things, that obstacles you have to overcome, and they do it, and they do it so that we will be informed and know what's happening. So having said that, we have now come to our audience questions, and I'm going to turn that over to Rachel.
Thank you, Anne. I'm looking at through your wonderful questions here. There are some similar themes, questions, again, about how to get beyond the choir, comments that Congress has just voted that climate change is not created by humans. So how do we get these issues out there? The question is, how do you resonate with an audience who are the people you most want to change but are the least likely to receive your message in good light? Any thoughts on that? Who'd like to start us off?
Well, this is Kevin White. Yeah. One of the nice things about broadcast, actually, I will say, is that I think you can reach a wider audience. And I think each film has it's released, you know, with festivals first and then maybe semi-theatrical. And in the semi-theatrical, a lot of that is just the nonprofits that are related to it. They like it, and then, you know, they have a lot of community screenings and you galvanize support. But then beyond that, when you start to go reach wider, I think broadcast can really play a big role to get people exposed to some of those stories. And I think to Mark's point and Leah as well, that, you know, if you make a film that has, you know, all the things that we cherish about being human, it has humor, it has pathos, it has all of that stuff in the story, it will reach people if they take the time to see it. Mm-hmm. And the key is just getting enough traction for people to go see it. And that's a hard one. I mean, I think part of this, you know, sometimes, you know, if somebody has a brother-in-law that says global warming doesn't exist, maybe the ticket is to not worry about giving them the facts about the science. Maybe the ticket is to talk to them about it in some other way, like the socioeconomics or the economic impact or the impact on real estate or a million other things that I think everybody has a sweet spot where, well, that's an issue that resonates with me. Mm-hmm. It may not be facts. I mean, there's so many scientists that have been talking about global warming for years, and yet data doesn't really move people. Stories move people. So, you know, that's the thing. And you just have to expose them to those stories. And sometimes they'll come around. Sometimes they won't. Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned that not only finding the story that's the hook, but people having the time. And I think, Mark, you had something you wanted to...
Yes.
We were talking earlier before the show about people and their time.
Yeah, and it's interesting that, to Kevin's point about, you know, broadcast is still the brass ring for all of us filmmakers. We want to get on broadcast. But there was an interesting thing in the paper today, I believe, might have been yesterday, that for the first time, there's more subscribers on Comcast for internet versus cable. That the new generation doesn't want cable. They don't want all that stuff. They're getting everything they need through the internet. And that's a huge opportunity for filmmakers to be able to know that, you know, if they watch your film, you know that they're watching it, and also you can connect an action to that, an action campaign to that, or it's something that, again, that goal, that end goal that you want people to do right after they see your film. And, you know, the short film is a great opportunity to do that. And that's one of the reasons we've been focusing on it. But one of the things, too, that we realize is that, you know, if you don't have that action ready for them to take right after they see your film, you know, it's the short attention span thing that we're all plagued with. And we've come up with something, a name of something that I want to show you this clip first, and then I'll explain what that is.
Hey, look, he's trained. Shake. Uh-huh. Speak.
Hi there.
Did that dog just say hi there?
Oh, yes.
Brad!
My name is Doug. I have just met you, and I love you. My master made me this collar. He is a good and smart master, and he made me this collar so that I may talk. Squirrel!
Squirrel!
My master is good and smart.
So that was a clip from the film Up, and we've affectionately named this the squirrel syndrome, because people get inspired and they want to do something, and there's this gap, and we call it an inspiration gap, where they can do something or
squirrel,
and they're on to something else. Right. And you have to be there with either capture an email, give them an action to do something that they, because they want to. If they're inspired, they will do something. But if they don't know what to do, you probably have maybe 5 minutes, starts to fade a little bit, a day, it's going further and further away. And then at the end, you know, after a week, you lose them. So we need to fight the squirrel syndrome and give people things to do right away.
A few more questions which follow on, I think, from the thread in a similar vein, which are, yes, how to keep the inspiration alive after the seats are empty, and providing tools for people. And a similar question for Leah and Mark about plans for educational outreach, which I think is probably connected, the tools we can provide people. And that's, you know, I guess another question about creating campaigns and extending the life of your films.
I wanted to pick up on the idea of empathy and focusing on human stories, partly because I feel like we as filmmakers, as this world is of production and distribution has changed, the hats that we have to wear are so many. And so to put the responsibility of, you know, the specific action and on the filmmaker is also hard. You know, I feel like partly it's about handing people a story with complex messages that, you know, speaks to a lot of people, and it will go places you never imagined. I mean, I'm somebody who designed a big outreach campaign for my first film. I've been very involved in outreach and engagement for my films, but I also feel like the secret is creating a story that it has its own legs in a way. And I was just going to say that I just came back from Indonesia, where the U.S. State Department sent me on this tour, which I when I got the email inviting me to be on this tour, I thought it was some sort of joke, because it was a cultural diplomacy tour, and they were really interested in my film because of water issues and development issues in Indonesia. I never imagined that this film about a little place in Mississippi would speak to audiences, you know, halfway across the world. I was in Aceh where the tsunami was, and where there's Sharia law, and, you know, a society that I knew very little about before getting there, and people so connected with Derek and with the issues, and, you know, because it's a human story. And I think, you know, you do everything you can to make the film accessible and to make it sort of part of a tool chest, give people resources and viewers' guides, but if you don't have a story that just on some fundamental level, you know, connects with people, that's a big hurdle. Yeah,
I think that's true for a lot of the environmental films we see and that we show at the festival, is that they really, the most brilliant and impactful stories are people at the center of the picture. And Mark, do you have anything to add on that? Because your films always have such interesting and varied characters.
Yeah, the thing I would add is that, you know, making the film, Kevin said this, is only half the battle. And many times, as, you know, if, I don't know if there are any funders in the audience, come and talk to me afterwards, including the radio audience. You know, when you're budgeting films these days, if you don't have an outreach campaign, it doesn't really make sense. You can't just make things anymore and hope that people are going to come and see it. You have to have a plan. You have, as Kevin was saying, you got to think about your audience, and, you know, do you do a Kickstarter campaign to start to build your audience as you're making the film? Many, many things. And, it is, even though my bio says I wear many hats, you know, doing an educational back end for a film is something that, again, if you can build that into a budget and have somebody that can do it that really knows how to do it, it's going to be much, much more powerful. And I know that the Redford Center, that was one of their goals, is they had a teaching guide. They went with it. They wanted educational distribution. Every time we screen the film, you know, parents would come up and how can we screen this for all of our kids? There's a desire for it, and the tools need to be built into the budgets as we make the films.
Kevin White.
I think that's absolutely right, and that, yeah. I think that distribution takes a team, and it takes a it takes a village. I mean, you really that's what it takes, and I think if you can have the money to plant enough really core competent folks to help you with all the elements of distribution. I mean, you know, these days with the web and social media, you know, it's a brand new time. Filmmakers and the producers of these films and who's ever organizing the campaign can interact with audience directly. That's huge. That's huge. So what is our biggest asset? Well, these days it's our mailing list, mm-hmm. right? And that's because that is what gets us out to in the mailing list that you develop in different niches. I mean, you know, we did a film about fourth graders restoring 23 up to 27 miles of watershed up in this Temple Creek watershed up in Sonoma. And, you know, that has resonance again all the time, because getting kids outside, getting them connected with their local watersheds, that's, you know, we have a big educational component to that. And a lot of teachers have got that film, and we're working with our distributor to get that out. And it's been very successful with teachers. And one of our core audiences, guess what? Parents of teachers.
Let's go.
Parents of teachers. Why? Because maybe this is the reason they get inspired about, this is the reason my child is going to teaching.
Oh.
So it's funny how when you start to think about, well, who might be interested in this film beyond just that first level? You know, so.
So do we have time for a couple more questions? Oh.
We do have questions. We have, unfortunately, just time for one more question. Okay. And if we can keep our answers a little bit succinct so that everyone gets to say something, that would be perfect.
Great.
And it's been a great panel. I certainly wish we could go on for a long time. But Rachel here.
And I think we have a little time afterwards if you want to stick around and ask more direct questions. Some of these questions are great. I wish we could get to them all. But here we end on the all-important question. Thank you for this. Do any of you have internships at your production companies? What keeps it all ticking along?
Well, this is Mark DeSena, and we do use interns, but one thing we feel is very important is to pay our interns. So it's, you know, especially in the most expensive city in the country, one of them anyway, you got to think about how your interns can survive. I have to think about how my employees survive. So we have very limited internships, and we do, but we try to make them paid internships. And the last thing I want to say is that I'm a product of growing up in 70s and 80s and the me first generation. I think it's time for the we first generation.
A big believer in interns. I started as an intern, and the people that I met as an intern have been advisors to me, and, you know, decades later, I'm still working with them. And Derek, the subject of my film, was another intern with me. So, but as you said, it's a huge investment also to mentor someone, and to so we don't take it lightly, but I welcome them. Yeah.
Yes, and this is Kevin, and yes, we have interns as well, and we try to pay them as well. Sometimes we can't pay them as much as we would always like to, but I do think this city is crazy expensive, and it's hard just to pay ourselves, you know, and it's one of the challenges. But I think that, you know, mentoring, I mean, on some level, I think we all owe, you know, we all have a responsibility to really help emerging filmmakers and it's not, while the tools to making films are probably, there's less, you know, barriers to making films in terms of the tool set, it's still just as hard to raise money and get traction and rise above the noise, you know. And so I think that to the extent that we can help that, that's something we're, you know, committed to doing, but it's not easy for anyone, I think. So.
Thank you, Kevin. The Green Film Festival as well does offer internships. And we have an army of volunteers. Now is a wonderful time to get involved as an usher. You can help at will call. You can help throw a great party. Our festival is May 28th through June 3rd. Details are at greenfilmfest.org. This has been a great discussion. We've just scraped the surface. It's been really fun sharing your work, your clips. I hope it's inspired you to learn more about the films and the work of our guests here this evening. So thank you very much to Mark DeSena, Leah Mahan, and Kevin White for joining us. Thank you.
Sure. As chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Committee, I get to ask actually the last question. It's my one thing in the evening. And mine is for actually Rachel. We really haven't heard from her very much about herself and how she came to be so interested and such a really wonderful pioneer in the work that she's doing. So, Rachel, it's your turn now to tell us how this all happened for you.
Oh, thank you, Anne. I am not a filmmaker. I have not made films, but I have worked for a long time with filmmakers. My passion is curating. I've worked for about 20 years for film festivals in the UK and Europe and the USA. Had been very motivated for a long time to do something that was more focused around environmental activism. And the more I was seeing films and attending screenings of the types of films being made by our guests here, I could see that this was an incredibly powerful tool. And not just when films are shown, you know, at home, watching on your laptop or your TV, but when we have chances to come together under one roof and share ideas and make connections. And then here in San Francisco, you know, we love our independent films, we love our film festivals, we love coming out to film festivals. We're at the forefront of environmental thinking. So it just seemed incredible these things hadn't already come together. And then with a lot of probably just, you know, not very right-minded thinking, a lot of insanity and sleepless nights, and with a lot of goodwill and many volunteers, the Green Film Festival came into being. We're in the fifth year. We've screened over 400 films in 5 years. We've got 60 new films at the festival coming up in May. And over 70 guests, and we hope you'll come and find inspiration and reactivation for your green core. So join us. Look forward to seeing you there.
This is Anne Clark. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Thanks, Rachel, for your remarks. And our program, the San Francisco Green Film Festival, Lights, Camera, Action, and Storytelling. As I mentioned, a big thank you to Rachel Kaplan, who's founder and CEO of the San Francisco Green Film Festival, and our terrific panel, Mark DeSena, founder of Content Films, writer and director of Watershed, Exploring a New Water Frontier, a New Water Ethic for the New West, Leah Mahan, producer and director, Come Hell or High Water, The Battle for Turkey Creek, and Kevin White, founder and executive director, Filmmakers Collaborative San Francisco. And a big thank you to you, our audience here tonight, and our audiences on the radio and the internet. You can find our programs at www.commonwealthclub.org, and you can access and download our programs by clicking on the multimedia section on our website. Please join us for our upcoming Environment and Natural Resources program. You have a green sheet on your chair, so take a look at what's happening, and I'll give you a short description of our next programs. May 13th will be an update on California's water drought with Felicia Marcus, chair of the State Water Resources Control Board. June 4th is one of my favorites. The title of it is, I Never Knew There Were So Many Stars in the Sky. And this is to learn what happens when ninth grade San Francisco students spend a week for the first time at San Francisco's Camp Mather and learn about our natural and state forests, mountains, rivers, as well as opportunities for work, careers, and the importance of protecting our environments. This wonderful educational program is sponsored by the San Francisco PUC and the San Francisco Park and Rec Department, as well as the San Francisco School District. So come and hear our ninth graders who are going to tell you what it's like to go to the mountains from their neighborhoods for the very first time. And finally, on June 17th, Dr. Leslie Wong, president of San Francisco State University, will discuss the worldwide challenges and the environment, difficult and necessary dialogues, and the importance of public universities and colleges have in facilitating discussions and communications. San Francisco State University will host the statewide Environmental California Higher Education Sustainable Conference. It's a great conference and open to everyone. The conference is here in San Francisco. You can contact San Francisco State for more information. It is a statewide conference, and the conference is from July 20th to July 24th. And finally, let me add my comments about don't forget. Don't forget the San Francisco Green Film Festival from May 28th through June 4th. We hope you will be there, and we will know that you will learn a lot and you will enjoy it, and it will be terrific as my panel has been tonight and our moderator. So again, thank you all for coming, and thanks to our panel and our moderator. This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than 112 years of enlightened discussion in the know, is adjourned.